Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present historian and national security policy analyst Gareth Porter, who discusses increasing violence in the U.S. war in Afghanistan and the likely evaporation of support for the war in Congress. Witness against torture activist Mark Colville, who talks about his group's campaign to close down the U.S. Guantanamo prison camp and the acquittal of 24 activists arrested during a U.S. Capitol protest in January. And Russell Mokyber, editor of Corporate Crime Reporter, who explains why he believes the government should aggressively pursue criminal prosecution against BP executives for their massive oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
More than 2,000 people are feared dead in a wave of ethnic violence that swept southern Kazakhstan in Central Asia. Some 400,000 people, mostly ethnic Uzbeks, were forced to flee their homes. Some government officials have charged that rogue elements within the Kyrgyz military, loyal to deposed President Kermanbek Bakiyev, had set off the ethnic purge. Interim government leader Roza Otunbayeva pressed ahead for a June 27 referendum on constitutional reform, dismissing pleas to delay the vote. Otunbayeva, visiting the riot-torn areas, told reporters, "Holding the referendum has become necessary because we must create a legal framework. If we allow delays, this will threaten us with further instability." According to U.S. Central Asia analyst Erica Murat, the unrest started out as a bar confrontation in the city of Osh on June the 10th and may have involved underground elements of the state military and gangs of ethnic Kyrgyz. The United Nations Commissioner for Human Rights concluded that the ethnic attacks were orchestrated, targeted, and well planned. Newly elected British Prime Minister David Cameron has apologized for the killing of 14 civilians by British soldiers 38 years ago on Bloody Sunday in Derry, Northern Ireland, during a civil rights march. Speaking in Parliament, Cameron embraced the conclusions of the official Seville report on Bloody Sunday. The Tory Prime Minister declared the events 38 years ago were unjustified and unjustifiable. It was wrong. The 5,000-page inquiry concluded that none of the 14 civilians on January the 30th, 1972, carried a gun and no warnings were given by British troops, no soldier was under threat, and the soldiers were the first to open fire. Bloody Sunday marked the largest military killing of civilians in the United Kingdom since the Peterloo massacre in 1819. According to the Guardian newspaper, Northern Ireland's Director of Public Prosecutions is now investigating whether to bring charges against the soldiers for murder, perjury, or perverting the cause of justice. The Seville report reversed the conclusions by the now discredited report by Lord Widgery in 1972, which accused the Bloody Sunday victims of having guns or bombs. Currently, there is no evidence to support these conclusions. Joe Duddy, a brother of one of the 14 people killed on Bloody Sunday, observed, "The Widgery report destroyed our loved ones' good name. Today, we clear them." Bloody Sunday led to a wave of political violence that consumed Northern Ireland for nearly 30 years. 35 years after the end of the Vietnam War, a joint American-Vietnamese panel on Agent Orange is proposing a $300 million cleanup fund to decontaminate areas exposed to dioxin used to defoliate jungle forests during the war. The fund will set aside $100 million to aid Vietnamese suffering from Agent Orange-related disorders over a 10-year period. Money is also dedicated to restoring ecosystems and cleaning up former Agent Orange sites in former U.S. air bases in Da Nang, Ben Ho, and Phu Cat. Walter Isaacson, co-chair of the Joint U.S.-Vietnamese Dialogue Group, told the Associated Press, "We are talking about something that is a major legacy of the Vietnam War, a major irritant to this important relationship." From 1962 to 1971, the U.S. military dropped 75 million tons of Agent Orange and other herbicides over a quarter of the former South Vietnam. Agent Orange destroyed 5 million acres of jungle in Vietnam, the same geographic area as the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. A health study released last year by the Canadian firm Hatfield consultants found dangerously high dioxin levels in blood and breast milk samples of people who live near the former Da Nang airbase. The report estimates 100,000 people living near the former airbases face ongoing risks of Agent Orange exposure. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
As the war in Afghanistan becomes ever more violent, the latest headlines in the U.S. press have focused on a public spitting match between U.S.-Afghan War Commander General Stanley McChrystal and the Obama administration. General McChrystal was called back to Washington to respond in person to his staff's insulting criticism of President Obama and senior White House officials quoted in a July 8th Rolling Stone magazine article. But the more important story involves a deteriorating situation in the Afghan war, with an alarming rise in the number of Taliban-organized suicide bombings and assassinations of government officials. This despite 30,000 additional U.S. troops deployed to Afghanistan by President Obama, now totaling 94,000. A major U.S. offensive in the rural area of Marjah in February initially was declared a success, but the Taliban have succeeded in infiltrating back into the area, undermining the Pentagon's clear hold and build strategy. A larger American offensive in the Taliban stronghold of Kandahar province, originally set for June, has been delayed due to the lack of local support and is expected to be launched this fall. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with historian and national security policy analyst Gareth Porter, who in a recent article predicted that the U.S. will soon confront an Iraq 2006 moment, where political support for the Afghan war will evaporate among members of Congress and other elite opinion makers. Here, Porter talks about the unraveling of the Afghan war and the interesting timing of a Pentagon announcement touting Afghans' nearly $1 trillion worth of untapped mineral wealth.
I think that there is a very clear parallel here between the situation that exists politically in the United States today with regard to the war in Afghanistan and the situation that existed in 2006 with regard to Iraq. And the parallel is that in Iraq in 2006, what was happening was that the war was so clearly turning into a sort of a sectarian civil war between the Sunnis and the Shia, particularly in Baghdad, that the United States military was powerless to really affect. And the way in which that story played out day after day in the news media was so demoralizing, not just for the U.S. public or primarily for the U.S. public, but rather for the political elite itself in Washington, D.C., members of Congress, the sort of punditry, the unelected elite, the foreign policy elite. All these people were watching this unfold and saying, "Oh my God, this is no good. This isn't working at all. We've got to do something. We've got to do something different." And this, I think, is already beginning to happen. The same process is beginning to happen in Afghanistan, if you understand that the McChrystal strategy, the so-called counterinsurgency strategy, that depended on being able to protect, quote-unquote, the population from the Taliban and thus sort of draw them into a process whereby they would get governance reform and development, this has simply and utterly failed in such an obvious way that I think that the media coverage is bound to begin to pick up the same theme and replay it many times in the coming weeks and months by the very nature of the war itself and the failure of the strategy.
Gareth, President Karzai, Afghan President Karzai, recently held what they call a Loya Jirga summit meeting of Afghan tribal leaders And President Karzai, he's been saying there is no military solution to this war and that we must sit down with the Taliban. How realistic is it that Karzai or the U.S. government or NATO will entertain the idea of serious negotiations with the Taliban when they appear to be winning on the battlefield?
Well, that, of course, is the single biggest question mark in my own mind about this war, is whether there could be a negotiated settlement, which is really the only realistic way out of this war. I think that the Taliban do, in fact, have an incentive for sitting down and negotiating an agreement that would result in some kind of compromise. First reason, of course, is that it is perhaps the only way to get U.S. troops out of the country for X number of years into the future. The Taliban obviously have an interest in eliminating the foreign military presence, not simply for political reasons, but because they're Afghans and their fellow Afghans are suffering. So, I mean, I think that that is sufficient reason in itself to bring them to the table. And I would add that there is plenty of evidence that the Taliban leadership has been sending signals, albeit somewhat subtle signals, that the U.S. news media has not seen fit to publish, except for my own writing about this, and Anand Gopal, who wrote one piece for the Wall Street Journal. They have sent signals to the Obama administration that they are willing to meet the single U.S. demand that the U.S. has made explicitly, which is that as part of a settlement, the Taliban has to agree that al-Qaeda cannot have any foothold in Afghan territory. And you hear from many sources that the tensions between Mullah Omar and the Taliban leadership on one hand and the al-Qaeda leadership on the other hand have grown in recent years rather than receding, and that they do not see eye to eye at all on their fundamental interests.
The Pentagon recently made an announcement about Afghanistan's vast riches in mineral wealth, including iron, copper, gold, and lithium. They value it at close to $1 trillion. This information, from what I understand, has been released before. What's behind the Pentagon's timing in releasing this information as the war kind of turns sour?
Well, it's clearly a transparent effort to try to put another reason for the United States staying in Afghanistan for a long, long time on the table. And, you know, my own fear, I have to say, is that it could be successful in the sense that so many people in this country are almost trained like Pavlov's dog to respond to the idea that, if there's wealth, there mineral wealth there that is valuable to the U.S. economy, then of course the United States either is going to have to stay, should stay, on one hand, that's sort of the center and the right, or the left saying, well, of course we shouldn't, but that's the way the United States is. Of course we're going to stay, and there's nothing to be done about it. And I think someone really has to stop and say, now, hold on a minute. There's no good reason for the United States to stay at all. It makes no difference whatsoever to the U.S. economy whether the Chinese are making deals to have mining of various kinds of minerals in Afghanistan or not. They're still going to go on the world market and we'll get whatever we want to pay for. And so this is all just irrelevant to the real issues that we need to face in Afghanistan.
That was Gareth Porter, historian, national security policy analyst, and author of the book Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power and the Road to War in Vietnam. Read his articles online at ipsnews.net. One of President Obama's first pledges upon taking office was that within his first year he would close the prison at Guantanamo Bay U.S. Naval Base in Cuba, which held hundreds of Bush-era war on terror suspects. That deadline was January 21, 2010. On January 11th of this year, the eighth anniversary of the first terrorism suspects being transferred to Guantanamo in 2002, 45 protesters with the group, witnessed against torture, began a fast in a church near the White House, which lasted 11 days, ending on January 21st. During that time, the group held many public protests to draw attention to their cause, aimed at pressuring President Obama to fulfill his pledge to close the Guantanamo prison camp. On January 21st, 24 Witness Against Torture activists brought their protest to the U.S. Capitol and were subsequently arrested for unlawful entry with disorderly conduct. After a trial in a Washington, D.C. Superior Court, those arrested were acquitted of all charges by Judge Russell Kanin on June 14th. Mark Coville, who runs the Catholic Worker House in New Haven, Connecticut, has been involved with Witness Against Torture for several years, including a trip to Guantanamo he made with other peace activists in December 2005 to visit prisoners held there, an effort blocked by the U.S. military. Here, Coville talks about some disturbing facts related to prisoner suicides at Guantanamo that influenced activists' decision to risk arrest, and how the judge in the trial arrived at his decision to acquit him and the other anti-torture defendants in the case.
During the time that we had been doing the 11-day fast, there was a revelations that came out about the deaths of three detainees that had died in, 2006, I believe it was. Three detainees at Guantanamo were reported to have committed suicide. And a whistleblower among the military personnel that were on duty that night had come forward and in an article in Harper's Magazine, which eventually came out in February of this year, it was exposed that all evidence points to the fact that these three were murdered by torture by the military personnel, and that the story of suicides was just a lie. One of the detainees was actually brought into Guantanamo when he was still a minor, and none of them had any connection to terrorism. The action on the 21st, a group of us decided that we would go inside the Capitol and we'd go on the Capitol, the tour. And during the tour, you stop in the rotunda, and there's a particular spot where presidents, when they're waked, they lie in state in the middle of the rotunda, where long processions go by and view the president's casket. Well, we went to that spot, and we laid down a banner with the names of these three people who had been murdered, and we did a service of repentance, some funeral prayers. And so it was a solemn ritual that we felt was important to do as an act of repentance on behalf of our nation. And we were arrested, obviously.
Mark Coville, you said an attorney working with your group had asked the judge to allow the necessity defense, that is, that you acted in order to try to prevent a worse catastrophe, which was the torture of prisoners at Guantanamo and at secret sites around the world. The judge, as is almost always the case, denied that motion. What happened next?
Three of us on the defendant's side rose and gave motions to the judge to acquit, and we were surprised to hear the judge considering these motions. Usually they're dismissed out of hand. But the judge asked a lot of questions of the prosecution before answering, and then in the end he ended up accepting one of the motions for acquittal. And his reasoning was that the prosecution hadn't proven specifics of the statute, particularly things involving threatening behavior and disruption. And he basically was, the way he was explaining it was that we were charged improperly by the prosecution. To most of us who were present, it did appear that the judge was had been moved by the justice of our cause, and he had been looking for a way to get through this without convicting us. I don't know. Obviously that's speculation, but. It became a victory of sorts, although as we all said when we walked out of the courtroom, we hope and pray that the detainees that still remain at Guantanamo can get afforded the same kind of treatment. First of all, a hearing in court, and then secondly, the feeling of being set free, which we were that day.
Do you see any difference between the Bush and Obama administration's policies regarding prisoners at Guantanamo?
The short answer to your question is no, and that's really discouraging to folks, is that there has been dialogue with the Obama administration. We feel that there's been listening going on from the other side, which is a substantive kind of change from the Bush administration. But as far as policy and practice, nothing has changed. And this is really, it's bewildering to progressive people who have been, you know, during those 8 years of Bush administration were just longing for change. And then the strong promise that appeared to be there with Obama's election. And I mean, I must say that policy-wise, nothing to this point has changed, to be honest. And everybody is obviously hoping that it will. But we can't say that anything has changed to this point.
That was Mark Colville of the New Haven Catholic Worker, La Casa Amistad, and Witness Against Torture. For more information on the group's anti-torture campaign, visit their website at witnesstorture.org. With British Petroleum's oil spill continuing to devastate the environment and the economy of the Gulf of Mexico, President Obama, in his first Oval Office address, spoke with the American people about his response to the single worst environmental disaster in American history. During his speech, Obama pledged to make BP pay for the damage it has caused along the Gulf Coast and criticized the company for its recklessness. The following day, Obama met with BP officials and secured an agreement to create a $20 billion escrow fund that will be tapped to compensate individuals and businesses that have suffered economic damage due to the oil spill. In a testament to how many friends money can buy, more than a few Republican legislators who receive big oil campaign contributions criticized Obama's pressure on BP to set aside the $20 billion to pay victims of the oil spill. Representative Joe Barton, Republican of Texas, was by far BP's best friend when at a House Energy Committee hearing on June 17th, he apologized to BP CEO Tony Hayward for what he described as a shakedown by the White House to set up the $20 billion escrow fund. Reprimanded by Republican leaders worried about a public backlash against the pro-corporate stance of the GOP, Barton later retracted his apology to BP. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Russell McIver, editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter, who criticized President Obama for not advocating criminal prosecution of BP executives. Here, McIver explains why he favors revocation of BP's U.S. corporate charter and excluding the company from being awarded any future government contracts.
Well, it's not a question of law. It's a question of resources and political will. And unfortunately, it doesn't look like the federal government has the political will to apply the resources. It has the resources. Just a little bit of background. A former head of the Environmental Crimes Unit at the Justice Department, who we interviewed a couple years ago, David Ullman, says that bringing these cases is definitely possible under the current law. In fact, he sent to prison executives of a major slaughterhouse from South Dakota for dumping slaughterhouse waste in a river in South Dakota a couple years ago. But when he went to court to prosecute the case, it was him and a young graduate assistant who was working at the Justice Department at the time, sitting at one table, and 14 high-paid corporate white-collar defense lawyers sitting representing the executives in the company at the other table. So the companies have the money and are willing to spend the money to defend themselves. And the question is the government willing to spend the money to prosecute these cases? And more importantly, does it have the political will? So I saw a recent poll saying that 75% of Americans think that Obama's not tough enough on BP. And I think what they mean is that there's no talk of putting these executives in prison. Obama didn't once mention the word crime or criminal justice or justice during his Oval Office TV speech on BP. And even though there is a federal criminal investigation, there's not much emphasis on bringing these executives to justice. And it's not going to be an easy case in the sense that BP is going to throw everything at it, and the government's going to have to do the same. Eric Holder, who's the attorney general, and his deputies are part of what I call Corporate Crime, Inc. So they're part of the business of prosecuting and defending and cutting these slap-on-the-wrist deals for corporations. Holder, for years, was in private practice representing corporate criminal defendants, and so were his deputies. And so you know, there's a revolving door of executives going from the defense side to the prosecution side. And if you don't play ball, you're not going to go back to the defense side. And by playing ball, that means, you know, not putting executives in jail when they deserve to be in jail. It means entering these deferred and non-prosecution agreements when you should be insisting on criminal pleas. So the signs are not good that there will be justice in the BP case for the people of the Gulf and for the Gulf itself.
Russell Mokhiber, tell us a little bit about British Petroleum's history of criminal activity in other spots beyond the Gulf of Mexico. What have they been doing over the last bunch of years?
Well, yeah, you see, so there is a history, and that's why some people believe that the corporate death penalty is called for here, that the state of Delaware, where BP is incorporated, should revoke BP's corporate charter. And send the company packing back to the UK, seize its assets and apply the assets to the creditors, which primarily are going to be the residents of the Gulf who've lost their livelihood and for the cleanup of the Gulf. BP is a corporate criminal recidivist corporation. There was an oil spill in the North Slope of Alaska where BP pled guilty to a crime. There was another case where the company was convicted also on the North Slope of hazardous waste violations. Third case in Texas City, Texas, where 15 workers were killed after an explosion. There was a guilty plea in that case. There was a deferred prosecution agreement in a propane price rigging case. So, yeah, there are a lot of options on the table. I think it's still a sort of fluid situation where, you know, the government, Obama administration, wants to limit the liability of the corporation. That's why they've hired Mr. Limited Liability himself, Ken Feinberg, to administer this $20 billion fund. He was very much involved with the Agent Orange case, where he sought to protect the interests of the corporations who manufactured Agent Orange. And so this is the way the government seeks to preserve corporate capital in these disasters. But even people like Robert Reich have argued that BP should put into some kind of environmental receivership, and the government should take control of the assets until we get some kind of resolution.
That was Russell Mokhiber, editor of Corporate Crime Reporter. Visit the publication's website at corporatecrimereporter.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.